There was no alternative. This I remember well from 1941. So what is that Fisher fellow up to at the moment, then? I could see her eyes oscillating between Herr Fischer's current circumstances and a comparative study of Balkan policy over the past 70 years. She opted for the former. The most important thing is that the Greens have no concerns about the talent in our ranks. Joschka Fischer was, and still is, an important figure in the history of the Green movement, but now it's the turn of others. Like you, for example. Amongst many others, yes. We had arrived at the map table. With flags, I had marked the places where the Bundeswehr was currently deployed. May I ask how the Greens would bring the operation in Afghanistan to a victorious conclusion? What do you mean, victorious conclusion? The military operation there must be brought to a speedy conclusion. It's only leading to more violence. I take the same view. There's nothing for us to gain in Afghanistan. What is our objective there? Hold on, she said. But
please don't say you have fresh misgivings about my motives, I said.
Please don't tell me you're allowed to withdraw from Afghanistan, whereas I have to stay there. I'm not sure I'm going to say anything, she said, her eyes darting around the studio. Her gaze came to rest below the map table. There's a briefcase, Kunast said superciliously. Is that meant to be there? Someone must have forgotten it, I said absently. Where is Stauffenberg, by the way? The briefcase had been another idea of mine. In fact, the whole incident had come back to me in sharp detail when we visited the Wolf's Lair. I suggested we could include it as a permanent feature in the programme. That and the visit to the map table. I thought we should hide the briefcase anew for each guest. Seeing as we've agreed on a withdrawal from Afghanistan, I said, leaning over the table, please tell us, to conclude, if the Greens took power in this country, which would be the first state they would annex?
The briefcase is ticking, Kunast said, dumbfounded.
That had been Sensenbrink's idea. He had hit on it moments before I did. Don't be daft, I said. Briefcases don't tick. A briefcase is not an alarm clock. Which state did you say? Is confetti going to come out of it? Or flour? Or soot?
For goodness sake, why don't you take a look?
That's exactly what you want me to do, isn't it? Come off it, I'm not stupid. Then you will never find out, I said. We, on the other hand, have found out many interesting things about your most congenial party. Many thanks for having spent the evening with us, Frau Renate Kunast! During the applause, I glanced backstage, where Sensenbrink and Madame Bellini were standing. They clapped and then stuck out their fists with thumbs pointing upwards. It felt wonderful.
Chapter 31. The most important skill I have acquired during my career as a politician is the ability to judge one's public obligations shrewdly. Essentially, I have always despised the dependence on benefactors. And yet, for the sake of his country, the politician frequently has to compromise. It may be that public handshakes and deference to the cream of society is an attraction for that caste of political artistes who confuse life in the public sphere with a life for the public sphere, for the nation, for the small man who scrimps and saves to put bread on his table and clothe his children. And anybody who spends even a quarter of an hour watching the news on his television set will, with grim certainty, see at least half a dozen of those bootlickers toadying up to some important person or other. Such behaviour has always repelled me, and I myself have only suffered various courtesy visits for the sake of the cause. Pure torture. But I undertook these for the sake of the party, for the German Volk, for the preservation of our race, or for a new Mercedes, and for the 400-square-metre apartment on Prinzregentenplatz, and I suppose for the Obersalzberg, too.
All these were acquisitions, however, which increased the appeal of the party and thus the movement, besides that of the Führer. When I think of the flood of visitors to the Obersalzburg, it astonishes me that anybody can maintain that it was a place where I could relax. And then there was Mussolini's visit. Ghastly. The point is, a Führer cannot withdraw from public life, or only intermittently. If his Reich capital is lying in ruins, then he may hole up for a while in his Führerbunker. Otherwise, the Führer belongs to his Volk. Which is why I was delighted to receive the invitation from Munich. Back in late August, a renowned society magazine had written me a letter in which the editor requested that I pay her publication a visit during the Greater German Volksfest, which had reverted to its original name of Oktoberfest. Everybody at Flashlight encouraged me to accept the invitation. For my part, I was hesitant at first. I had never been there during the first period of my life, but times had changed, and with them the significance of this fortnight-long tradition. As several people reassured me, the Oktoberfest had now become a Volksfest which took place without involving a particularly large proportion of the population. Anybody wishing to sit and partake of food and drink in one of the tents had to reserve a place months, sometimes years, in advance, or else reschedule their visit to a time of day when no decent German would ever dream of going there. Well, no person sound of mind would plan an innocent affair such as a visit to a Volksfest months or years in advance. As a consequence, so I learned, the place teemed in the morning and early afternoon with indecent Germans, as well as foreigners and tourists, attracted by the aura of the famous festival. Already by lunchtime, these people tried desperately to make an evening of the day. Both Madame Bellini and Sensenbrink warned me against making an appearance too early, as it implied that one was an insignificant peripheral figure. The evenings were not for the local population either, but for businesses from every branch of industry imaginable. Practically any firm with half a name for itself felt obliged to arrange visits to the Wiesn for its clients or the press. Some organs of the press, however, dissatisfied with what was on offer or with the guests present, had taken it upon themselves to tailor a more congenial visit to the Wiesn. To my mind, this was a terribly smart, indeed positively Goebbels-like course of action. Some of these gatherings, I was assured, were now as important as the opera balls of old, and this magazine's soirée was amongst the most important. My acceptance, moreover, turned out to be a particularly effective propaganda coup. In the past, I had kept my distance from the festival, and now several tabloid newspapers were able to write on their front pages, "Führer's First Fest." The smooth relationship I now enjoyed with these papers, I reflected with no little satisfaction, meant that the need to establish a new Völkischer Beobachter was dropping down my list of priorities. I had arrived in the city around noon, and used the time to call in on some much-loved old haunts. I lingered for a while at the Feldherrnhalle, remembering the blood spilled by loyal comrades there. I wandered nostalgically past the Hofbräukeller. Then, with some apprehension, I walked to Königsplatz. But how my heart beat for joy when I saw all the magnificent buildings still standing unscathed. The Propylaea, the Glyptothek, the State Collection of Antiquities. And, this I had scarcely dared to hope, not only were the Führerbau and the NSDAP administrative building still standing, but they were in use, too. It had not escaped even those opinionated and cocksure Democrats that Königsplatz was only complete with the addition of these highly refined constructions. Feeling gay, I continued my stroll through Schwabing. My feet took me, as if of their own accord, to Schillingstrasse, and to an unhoped-for reunion. It would be hard to convey the sheer magnitude of my delight when I spied the sign for the Osteria Italiana, behind which hid none other than my old hangout, the Osteria Bavaria. I would have loved to have gone in and partaken of something small, a glass of mineral water perhaps. But time was marching on, and I had to return to my hotel from where an automobile was to fetch me that evening. My arrival at the Theresienwiese, site of the Oktoberfest, was sobering. Police had cordoned off the vast site, but they were making no efforts to ensure security or order. Barely had I got out of the automobile than two exceedingly drunken individuals staggered towards me and fell into the back seat. "Brrrr, one of the two slurred, while the other seemed to be dozing already. The chauffeur, a powerful man, expelled the two drinkers at once with the words, "Oi! Out! This isn't a taxi!" He then accompanied me to the venue. "Sorry about that," he said. "It's always like this at the bloody Oktoberfest." We walked the short distance across the street to the festival site. It was hard to believe that anybody could have struck upon the idea of holding a soiree of any social importance in this godforsaken place. Endless lines of drunkards leaned with their heads against temporary fences, urinating through them. Waiting for a number of these characters were women in a similarly precarious state. It was quite evident that they would have liked to do the same, but dared not due to some subconscious residue of decency. Propped against an advertising column, a couple were engaged in an act of courtship. The man's intention was to thrust his tongue into her mouth, but because she slipped downwards, he missed his target and had to make do with her nose. Responding to his intrusiveness, she opened her mouth and poked her tongue aimlessly in the air. The two of them slid, slowly at first, then more rapidly, down the column until they hit the ground. They shrieked with laughter and tried to say something, but a lack of consonants rendered their babble unintelligible. Lying beneath the woman, the man wriggled about, sat up briefly, and then silently plunged a hand into her cleavage. Although it was uncertain whether the woman noticed this at all, three Italians, on the other hand, watched with interest and decided to follow events at closer quarters. These ignominious endeavours failed to attract the attention of anybody else, and certainly not that of the police, who were busy picking unconscious bodies, of which there were plenty, from the ground. In spite of its name, the Theresienwiese, Teresa's meadow, possesses very little grass. The only patches of green are to be found around the trees which encircle the site. In this respect, nothing had changed since my first time in Munich. As far as I could make out, drunkards, some of them comatose, occupied almost every one of these patches of grass. Whenever I eyed a vacant spot, I could already see someone reeling towards it. Once at his temporary resting place, he would either collapse, throw up, or both. "Is it always like this?" I inquired of the chauffeur.
"Friday's worse," he replied calmly. "Bloody Oktoberfest."
I cannot explain why, but all of a sudden the reason for this human devastation hit me like a bombshell. It must have been down to a decision taken by the NSDAP in 1933 to increase further the party's popularity amongst the Volk. We fixed the price of beer. Since then, other parties had evidently tried to secure their popularity by the same means. "How typical of these fools," I blurted out. "Haven't they raised the price of beer? These days, 90 pfennigs for a litre is a joke."
"What do you mean, 90 pfennigs?" the chauffeur asked. "It's €9 a litre, mate. 10 if you include a tip."
As I walked past, I saw the extraordinary wreckage of beer corpses. Somehow, despite all their economic mismanagement, these parties must have brought about an unexpected level of prosperity. Well, not having to wage war certainly saves the odd cost. Looking at the state of the Volk here, however, even the most deluded individual would have to admit that in 1942 or 1944, yes, even in the most harrowing nights of bombardment, the Germans were in better shape than on this September evening at the beginning of the third millennium. Physically, at least. Shaking my head, I followed the chauffeur, who delivered me to a blonde woman at the entrance to a tent, and then returned to his vehicle. With cables around her head and a microphone in front of her mouth, she said with a broad smile, "Hi there, I'm Chill, and you are?" "Schmuel Rosenzweig," I said, feeling irritation rise again. Was I really that difficult to recognize? "Thanks, Rosenzweig, Rosenzweig," she repeated. "I haven't got any Rosenzweigs on the list."
"Heavens above!" I cursed. "Do I look like a Rosenzweig? Hitler! Adolf!"
"You could have said that in the first place," she wailed with such a quiver in her voice that I almost felt sorry for my remark.
"Have you got any idea of how many people we get here? I can't be expected to know them all. Especially not if they start giving false names. Earlier I got Becker's wife mixed up with his ex-girlfriend. He gave me a right roasting for that."
I am no stranger to sympathy. A true Führer feels for each and every one of his fellow Germans as if they were his own children. But pity never helped anyone.
"Brace yourself," I said sharply. "You are at this post because your superior officer is depending on you. Do your best, and he will not fail to lend you his support."
She gave me a look of bewilderment, but, as often happens in the trenches, my harsh words must have sparked some courage in her. She nodded and led me to the party in the upper section of the tent, where I was immediately introduced to the editor. This was a seasoned blonde lady in a dirndl, with shining blue eyes. Her vivacity convinced me that she would have made a perfect office supervisor in party headquarters. I might not necessarily have entrusted her with a newspaper, although a gossip sheet with health tips and knitting patterns, that might work, who knows? She was probably very keen to talk. She looked as if she had already raised 4 or 5 children, and she must be terribly lonely at home.
"Ah," she beamed. "Herr Hitler!"
The corners of her eyes twinkled mischievously, as if she had just cracked an hilarious joke. "Correct," I said.
"I'm so delighted you're here."
"Madam, the pleasure is all mine," I said. And before I could add another word, her face broke into an even more radiant smile. When she turned to the side, I assumed that a mandatory photograph was about to be taken. Adopting a serious expression, I turned in the same direction, there was a flash, and my audience was at an end. In my mind, I rapidly sketched a 4-year plan, according to which this editor would spend at least 5 minutes talking to me here next year, and 20 the year after that. Only in theory, of course, because by that stage my intention was to be able to say a polite, "No, thank you," to these sorts of invitations. Then she would have to make do with someone like Göring.
"Catch you later," the editor said silkily. "I hope you can stay for a while."
At which a young woman dressed in folk costume dragged me over to a gaggle of women similarly dressed. This was one of the most frightful regional customs I had ever had the misfortune to experience. Not only the editor and this young woman, but every last damsel in the locality had felt obliged to squeeze herself into dresses which were zealously styled on those worn by country wenches, but which even at first glance revealed themselves to be hideous imitations. We had gone down the same path in the League of German Girls, I admit, but there, as the name implies, we were dealing with girls. Assembled here,
by contrast, were predominantly women whose girlhood lay at least a decade in the past, if not several. I was led to a beer table where a number of people were already seated.
"What can I get you?"
asked a waitress, whose dirndl at least bore the authenticity of an honest work uniform.
"A liter?" "Still water, please," I said.
She nodded and vanished. "Hey, a pro," said a large coloured man sitting next to a blonde at the other end of the table. "But you gotta get that in a large tankard. Looks better in the photos. Believe me, I've been doing this for 50 years now."
He gave me an unbelievably broad grin, exposing a staggering number of teeth.
"Doesn't look so good to be at the Wiesn with a water glass."
"Rubbish. Still waters run deep,"
said a rather rattled, dirndl-clad woman opposite me. I later heard on the grapevine that she earned her livelihood in one of those amateurish drama series. That is, when she wasn't featuring in another transmission, which, if I understood it correctly, consisted of equally third-rate personalities being taken to ancient woodland, where they allowed themselves to be observed wading through worms and excrement.
"You do funny stuff. I've seen some of your programmes," she said, taking a sip from her tankard and bending forward to afford me a view of her cleavage.
"Pleased to meet you," I said. "I've seen a couple of your things too."
"Should I know you?"
a young blonde man asked from the other side of the table.
"Of course,"
the Negro said, signing a photograph for another man with a thick felt pen.
"That's Hitler from Gagmess. Fridays, my TV. No, hang on, he has his own program now. You gotta watch it, it'll crack you up."
"But it's different from the usual, it's kind of political too,"
the rattled cleavage said.
"It's almost like the Harold Schmidt show."
"Not my cup of tea, I'm afraid," the blonde man said, turning to me.
"Sorry, mate, nothing personal, but politics. I just think nothing ever changes. All those parties and that, it's just a mess."
"A man after my own heart," I said, as the waitress placed my mineral water on the table.
I took a sip and looked down into the main room of the tent, expecting to see people swaying to and fro in time to the music. But no one was. Everyone was standing on tables and benches, with the exception of those who had just fallen off. People were wailing and shouting for someone called Jude. I tried to remember whether Goering had ever mentioned this mass debauchery after one of his visits, but my memory harboured no such recollection.
"Where'd you come from?"
the rattled woman asked.
"South Germany, right?"
Once more her cleavage was held up to me like an offering bag.
"From Austria," I said.
"Like the real one,"
the cleavage said. I nodded and allowed my gaze to wander around the tent. There was a shriek. Then some of the women in their ludicrous dresses attempted to clamber onto the benches and persuade others to join in. There was a hint of desperation about these unappealing women with their affected high spirits, but perhaps appearances were deceptive, and it was merely a consequence of their heavily swollen lips, which, despite every effort, gave their mouths a sulking, even offended expression. I took a casual glance at the lips of the rattled cleavage opposite me. They, at least, looked normal.
"I don't like all that injecting either,"
the cleavage said.
"I'm sorry?"
"Well, you were looking at my lips, weren't you?"
She took a sip of beer.
"I won't let a doctor near them, even though I sometimes think I'd have an easier time of it. I mean, none of us are getting any younger, are we?"
"A doctor? Are you feeling poorly?"
"You're very sweet,"
the cleavage said, bending over the table, tempting one to gather up the contents. Grabbing my shoulder, she turned me so that we were both looking in the same direction. She gave off an odour of beer, albeit not yet at a disagreeable level. Then, with slight twitches of her index finger, she pointed from right to left at the array of women.
"Boob job, nose job,
boobs, arse, dunno, lips, arse, boobs, a while ago now. Dunno, nose, lips, boobs and arse, paid for by the telly channel or production company. She did it for a special report.
She sat down again and looked at me.
You've had something done, though, haven't you?
I've had what done?
This similarity, police. The whole industry's scratching their heads, wondering who did it. Although,
here she took another gulp of beer,
if you ask me, you should sue the bastard.
My good woman, I have not the faintest idea what you are talking about.
Operations, for God's sake,
she said with a tone of irritation.
Don't pretend like you've not had one. That's plain silly.
Of course there were operations, I said, confused. She was a likeable woman in her own way. Sea lion, Barbarossa, Cerberus.
Never heard of them. Were you pleased?
Down below they were playing Pilot, Give a Wave to the Sun, which put me in a pleasantly nostalgic mood. I sighed. To begin with, everything was fine, but then there were complications. Not that the English would have done any better, or the Russians. But still, she scrutinized me.
I don't see any scars,
she said with the air of a professional. I'm not going to complain, I said. The deepest wounds are those that fate inflicts upon our hearts.
You're right there,
she said with a smile, holding her beer towards me. I matched her gesture with my mineral water, then continued in my attempt to determine the nature of this strange company. Youth was poorly represented here, and yet most people seemed to be behaving as if they were not a day older than 20. I dare say this was the reason behind the parade of décolleté, as well as the behaviour of one or two individuals. It was disconcerting. The impression it made upon me was so strong that I could not shake it off. All these men who were unable to tolerate their physical decline or compensate for this with cerebral work or at least a certain maturity. All these women who refused to sit back contentedly, having bred and reared their children for the Volk, but conducted themselves as if this were their one and only opportunity to reclaim their withered youth for a few precious hours. I would have loved to take these characters by the scruff of the neck and shout, "Pull yourselves together! You are a disgrace to yourself and to your fatherland!" I was ruminating on such matters when a man approached the table and rapped on it with his knuckles. "Evening," he said in that unmistakable dialect which always reminded me of Stryker's beautiful city. He was in his mid-40s or older, with long, dark hair, and was accompanied by what must have been his daughter.
"Lothar,"
the raddled cleavage said, shifting to one side.
"Take a pew."
"No, I'm not staying. I just wanted to say, I think what you're doing is brilliant. I saw the show on Friday. I nearly wet myself. But also, what you say is so true. All that Europe stuff and that. And the week before, that stuff with those social what's-its." "Social parasites," I said.
"Exactly," he said. "That and all that stuff about kids. Kids really are our future. You really hit the nail on the head.
I just wanted you to know."
"Thank you," I said.
"I am most pleased. Our movement needs your support, and I would be delighted if I could count your dear daughter amongst our supporters, too." All of a sudden, he looked incensed. Then he burst out laughing and turned to his daughter.
"There he goes again, utterly ruthless. Get you where it really hurts."
Then he rapped his knuckles on the table once more and said, "Ciao."
"You do know that's not his daughter, don't you?"
the cleavage said when this Lothar had left. "I assumed as much," I said. "Of course it couldn't be his biological daughter. Racially it just doesn't work. I assumed he'd adopted the girl. I've always been a strong advocate of adoption,
Much better than having such a poor young thing grow up in an orphanage.
The cleavage rolled her eyes.
Can't you say anything normal at all?
She sighed.
I need to go to the little girl's room. Don't run away. You might be awful, but at least you're not boring.
I took a sip of water. I was still wondering what to make of the evening when I was aware of a commotion behind me. A lady enveloped by a throng of journalists. The lady appeared to be one of the principal attractions of the event, as she was pursued by photographers and television cameras almost without pause. She had a southern complexion, which made her dirndl look particularly odd, and the arrangement of her décolleté was grotesque. This notwithstanding, if her overall appearance could be described as respectable in a vulgar sort of way, such an impression was shattered the moment she opened her mouth. She spoke at a pitch higher than that of any mechanical saw I ever heard. But the photographers and reporters were indifferent to the noise. She was just about to squeak into a camera when a photographer caught sight of me in the background and steered her to my table for a picture of the two of us. The lady appeared unenthusiastic. I know that look. Behind the eyes, laughing superficially, I could detect a merciless machine, calculating whether or not this photograph would prove advantageous to her. What helped me to see through her expression was that I was making the same calculation myself, albeit much more rapidly and, moreover, producing an answer in the negative. Her hesitation told me that she, on the other hand, seemed not to have arrived at a conclusion. For her, the consequences were uncertain, and hence a risk, which she would rather have evaded with a witticism. By now, however, one of the photographers had surged forward and tossed into the fray the slogan, "Beauty and the Beast," from which moment the baying pack of press hounds was no longer stoppable. So the exotic reckoning machine took the bull by the horns and rushed towards me, shrieking with laughter. This type of woman is not a new phenomenon. She existed 70 years ago, too, although she was not then as prominent. Her craving for recognition knows no bounds, and her self-esteem is low. She endeavours to assuage this by trying to conceal each one of her supposed deficiencies. For unfathomable reasons, this type of woman considers only one method to be suitable: turning everything into ridicule. She is the most dangerous type of woman a politician can meet.
"Well, it's you,"
she whinnied, trying to throw herself at me.
"How fab! Can I call you Addie?"
"You may call me Herr Hitler," I told her soberly. That is sometimes all it takes to put people off. She was undeterred, however. Sitting on my lap, she said,
"Cool, Herr Hitler. So what are the two of us going to do for those cheeky old photographers, eh? Hmm?"
In such a situation, one has nothing to gain and everything to lose. 99 out of 100 men would have lost their nerve at this point and beaten a retreat on the pretext of readjusting the front line or redeploying units. I had seen it often enough in the Russian winter of 1941, which, at -30, even -50 degrees, descended so suddenly on my troops. There was no lack of people who said, "Retreat! Retreat!" I alone held my nerve and said, "On no account, not 1 meter backwards! Any man who yields will be shot!" Napoleon failed, but I held the front, and in the spring we harried those banded-legged Siberian bloodhounds like hares, over the Don, to Rostov, to Stalingrad, and so on. I don't wish to go into unnecessary detail now. At any rate, there was no question of a retreat back then, nor now, in this unpleasant beer tent. The situation is never hopeless if one possesses a fanatical will to victory. One only need think of the miracle which blessed the House of Brandenburg in 1762. Tsarina Elizabeth dies. Her son, Peter, concludes peace. And Frederick the Great is saved.
Had Frederick surrendered beforehand, there would have been no miracle. No kingdom of Prussia, nothing at all. Just a dead Tsarina.
Many people say one cannot count on miracles. I say one can. One need only wait for them to appear.
Until that time, one must hold one's position. For an hour,
a year, a decade.
You know, madam, I said, winning myself some time, I'm so pleased to be back here again, in beautiful Munich, the capital city of my movement. Did you know that?
No, how interesting, she squeaked cluelessly, and ran her fingers through my hair. For bints like this, it is the simplest matter in the world to belittle a figure of authority by upsetting his appearance. If Providence had a miracle up her sleeve, then now was the time to unveil it. All of a sudden, one of the photographers thrust a fat black pen under my nose.
Why don't you sign the dirndl?
The dirndl?
Of course! Yeah, fab idea!
This comment was fired from one of his colleagues. The basest human instincts are the most reliable of allies, especially if one lacks any others. The wench had not the slightest interest in having her dress signed. The photographers were most insistent, however. They must have scented a variation on the usual lewd cleavage photo. And she could offer only limited resistance to their entreaties.
He who lives by the sword dies by the sword, even if the sword is no more than a camera.
In any event, I spied an opportunity to stall the enemy, maybe even bring up some reinforcements.
May I, madam?
But only on the material, she squealed hesitantly. And don't make it too big.
Of course, I said, and got down to business. Every second of time I won here counted double. So I augmented my signature with a few embellishments. I felt quite foolish, and after a while had to stop. I was beginning to resemble one of those little girls doodling in her friendship book.
Finished, I said regretfully. One of the photographers said, Flippin' heck.
The woman followed his gaze. I watched with surprise as her horrified eyes widened to the size of saucers. Do excuse me, I know it's a bit messy in the folds. That wouldn't have happened, of course, with a normal drawing block. Did you know I used to be a painter once?
Are you off your head?
She screeched, leaping off my lap. I could scarcely believe it. The Oktoberfest miracle. I'm sorry, madam, I said. I'm not sure I quite understand you.
I can't go wandering around the Oktoberfest with a swastika on my chest.
But of course you can, I reassured her. This isn't 1924, you know.
This country may not have a sensible government, but the parliamentary windbags absolutely swear by freedom of expression, and...
She was no longer listening. Instead, she was rubbing so furiously around her décolleté that it almost looked indecent. And even if I could not fully grasp her despair, the situation seemed to have been saved. She was the one who ended up not looking so good in the photographs. And, in fact, the television reports were even better. She could be seen springing up, her face hideously contorted, and issuing a volley of insults. Most of the reports concluded with her driving off a few minutes later in a taxicab, looking livid and firing off the most astonishing expletives. When all is said and done, I would have preferred a more dignified appearance. But given the circumstances, the outcome was more than respectable. At any rate, I considered my own losses to have been lower than those of the enemy. The folk always loves the watchful victor, he who knows how to defend himself.
He who wastes no more effort on such a person than he would on a fly. I was about to order another mineral water when one was set on the table before me.
From the gentleman over there with his compliments,
the waitress said, pointing into the distance. Peering through the throng of people, I saw, several tables away, a blonde figure whose face was the colour of a farmyard hen. His wrinkles gave him the appearance of an ancient Louis Trenker, all in all making him look as if he were pulling a bizarre grin. When he caught my gaze, the gentleman raised an arm in greeting, his fist balled and his thumb sticking upwards. He tried desperately to broaden his leathery smile, but to no avail. I rubbed my eyes and resolved to decamp as soon as I could. It was conceivable that the drinks here were being adulterated, for right beside that gentleman sat a carbon copy of the wench who had just left the tent with a swastika on her chest.
Chapter 32. It is amazing the paths that Providence will find to reach her goal. She allows one man to die in the trenches and another to survive. She guides a simple corporal to the conference of a tiny splinter party, which he will later lead as it attracts millions of members. Some who are destined for greatness, she sentences to a year of incarceration in the very middle of their life's undertaking, so that they can find the time to write an illustrious book. She also makes provision for an indispensable Führer to fetch up on the program of a Turkish imp, only to surpass the latter with such ease that he has his own program thrust upon him. And I am also sure that it was down to Providence that Fräulein Kurmeier knew nothing about razor blades. Once more, it was time to pause for thought. Although I had always believed in the significance of my return, in the onslaught of current events, my quest to ascertain this significance had temporarily taken a back seat. And for the time being, there were no other urgent matters to attend to. At present, the folk seemed to be free of the grosser hardships and humiliations, but now fate resolved to open my eyes as once it had in Vienna. Hitherto, I had engaged in minimal contact with everyday life. Fräulein Kurmeier had relieved me of any minor chores. It was only when I decided to run a few errands myself that I discovered the extent to which many things had changed. Of late, I had been missing my good old safety razor. Until now, I'd had to familiarize myself with a makeshift plastic apparatus, the purported virtue of which was that it combined several inadequate blades which scraped the skin simultaneously but unpleasantly. As I was able to discern from the packaging, this was regarded as major progress, especially in relation to the former version, which contained one fewer blade. But I could see no advantage vis-à-vis a single blade. I attempted to describe to Fräulein Kurmeier what one of these looked like and how it functioned, in vain. And so I was forced to make the trip myself. The last time I had properly gone shopping was back in 1924 or 1925. In those days, one would go to a haberdashery or soap shop. To purchase a razor nowadays, one had to frequent the chemists. Fräulein Kurmeier had told me how to get there. Rossmann was the name. Upon arrival, I realized that the appearance of the chemists had changed out of all recognition. Once upon a time, there was a counter, and behind this counter were the goods. Although there was still a counter, now it was situated close to the entrance. Behind it was nothing but a window display. The actual goods were stacked on an endless succession of shelves for every man to help himself. My initial supposition was that there were dozens of sales assistants, all in informal dress. But it turned out that these were the customers, who wandered about collecting their items and then took these to the counter. It was most disconcerting. Rarely
had I felt so impolitely treated. It was as if I had been told on the way in to look for the paltry razor blades myself, as the chemist had better things to do.
Gradually, however, I grasped the logistics inherent here. There were indeed a number of advantages to this system. First of all, the chemist could make large sections of his sales depot accessible, thus affording him greater selling space. Furthermore, it was obvious that 100 customers would serve themselves quicker than 10 or even 20 shop assistants could have done. And, last but not least, one could save money by dispensing with these shop assistants. The benefits were crystal clear. I made a swift estimate that by introducing this principle across the board, 100,000 to 200,000 troops could be freed up for immediate deployment at the front. This was so impressive that I intended to congratulate the ingenious chemist straight away. I hurried over to one of the counters and asked for Herr Rossmann.
Which Herr Rossmann?
For goodness sake, the man who owns this chemist's.
He's not here.
This was a great shame. But I soon discovered my congratulations would have been premature. For clever Herr Rossmann did not, regrettably, sell my razor blades. I was sent to another chemist's, one belonging to Herr Müller. To be brief, Herr Müller had likewise implemented Herr Rossmann's inspired idea. But he didn't have my blades either, nor did Herr Schlecker, whose frightfully squalid premises were run according to an even more extreme principle. Even the cash desk was unmanned here. Which, in a way, was perfectly logical, because I couldn't find my razor blades. The conclusion I drew from my dismal experience was that fewer shop assistants in Germany were selling no razor blades. It may not have been a happy state of affairs, but at least it was efficient. At a loss, I continued to wander past parades of shops. Once again, my decision to have worn a simple lounge suit had proved to be the right one. I was able to acquire, at close quarters, a genuine impression of the circumstances of the German folk, their fears, their concerns, and their razor-blade hardships. And now that I had been made aware of the fact, I realized that not only the chemists, but the whole of society had been organized according to this curious work principle. Every clothing shop, every bookshop, every shoe shop, every department store, even grocers and restaurants, all of these were virtually unstaffed. And money, it turned out, was no longer obtained from the bank, but from machines. Exactly the same was true of tickets for travel and stamps. They were liquidating the post offices, one and all. Packages, too, were pushed into a machine from which they had to be fetched by the recipient. Given all this, the new Wehrmacht ought to have had an army of millions at its fingertips. In reality, however, it had with difficulty scraped together only twice the number to which we had been restricted by the scandalous Treaty of Versailles. It was puzzling. Where were all those people? My initial assumption had been that they must be building autobahns, draining swamps and such like. Yet this was not the case. Swamps were a rarity these days, and tended to be refilled rather than drained. And autobahns were still being built by Poles, White Russians, Ukrainians and other foreign workers, for wages that were more cost-effective for the Reich than any war. Had I known back then just how cheap it was to employ Poles, I might as well have leapfrogged their country. One lives and learns. The thought did occur to me that the German Volk might have shrunk, with the result that all these extra people simply didn't exist. The statistics, however, showed that there were 81 million living Germans. I expect you are wondering why I had not considered the possibility of unemployment. The reason being that my mind had a very different recollection of what unemployed men looked like. The jobless man I remembered from the past went out onto the street with a placard around his neck that read, "Looking for any type of work." When he'd had enough of
drifting fruitlessly around in this manner, he would remove the placard, grab a red flag handed to him by a loitering Bolshevist, and return to the street. An army of millions of angry jobless men was fertile ground for any radical party, and I was fortunate enough to have led the most radical of them all. But in the streets of today, I could not see any unemployed men, nor was there any evidence to substantiate the hypothesis that they had been rounded up for some labour service or sent to a camp. Instead, as I later discovered, the country had chosen the capricious solution of a certain Herr Hartz. This gentleman had established that one does not earn the favour of the workers only through higher wages and such like, but also by supplying their representatives with money and Brazilian lovers. By means of a number of laws, this formula had been extended to the workers themselves, albeit with lesser inducements, of course. Rather than running to the millions, the sum was considerably more modest, and rather than real Brazilians, there were pictures of Hungarian or Romanian ladies of pleasure on the internet work, which presupposed that every jobless man was in possession of one or more computer. In this way, Herr Rossmann and Herr Müller were able to go on filling their pockets in their staffless and razor-blade-less trade without having to fear that the unemployed might smash their shop windows. The whole scheme was paid for out of the taxes of the small man from the munitions factory. And for the experienced National Socialist, everything pointed to a conspiracy of capital, of Jewish finance. Using the money of the poor, the even poorer were placated to the benefit of the rich in such a way that their businesses could happily continue to profit from the crisis. Politicians on the left never tired of pointing this out, although by neglecting to mention the Jewish element, their explanations fell short. There could be no question that not only Jewish finance, but world Jewry as a whole must be involved here. Only now was the true villainy of the plot revealed. And this, it struck me like a thunderbolt, was the task Providence had reserved for me. In this liberal bourgeois world of make-believe, I alone was able to recognize and expose the truth. Superficially, one could make a strong case that Herr Hartz and his social democratic accomplices had achieved their purported objectives. A white Russian woman on the computer, a warm, dry apartment and sufficient food, did all these not represent redistribution in the socialist sense? No. The truth could only be understood by the man who knows the Jews. The man who knows that with them there is no left and no right, and that both sides work hand in hand in perpetuity. And only the perspicacious spirit who sees through all the disguises could recognize that in their aim to eliminate the Aryan race, nothing had changed. The final struggle for the Earth's scarce resources would come, far later than I had prophesied, but it would come nonetheless. And the aim was so clear that only a fool could deny it. The Jewish hordes were planning once more to flood the Reich with their repulsive masses. But they had learned from the last war. Because they realized their inferiority, they resolved to undermine, reduce, and annihilate the valor of our Volk. So that when the day came, the Asiatic millions would be met only by effeminate Hartzmen, helplessly waving their mouse devices and television control boxes. I was chilled to the bone with horror, and the nature of my mission was transparent. I must resolutely follow this path. I elected at once to look for somewhere else to live. The hotel was no longer to be my home. I needed a proper base. Chapter 33. I had in mind something similar to where I had stayed in Prinz Regentenplatz in Munich. An apartment large enough for me, guests, staff, preferably an entire self-contained floor. But not a house. A villa with a garden, even with dense shrubbery,
is far too easy a target for one's political opponent to monitor or raid. No, a large apartment, close to the centre of town, in a lively area. This still has its advantages. And if it were right next door to a theatre, I wouldn't mind.
Don't you like it here any more?
Asked the receptionist, who by now was totally uninhibited and saluting me correctly. There was a jocular undertone to her question, but also a perceptible and sincere regret.
"I thought about taking you with me," I replied.
"My sister used to keep house for me, but she's no longer alive, I'm sorry to say. Were I able to pay your hotel salary, I would very happily offer you a job."
"Thanks," she said. "I like the variety here. Still, it's a shame."
In the past, someone else would have taken care of finding an apartment. Now I had to take the matter in hand myself. In one respect, this was interesting, because it brought me into contact with contemporary life. On the other hand, it also brought me into contact with agency riffraff. It soon became evident that, without an estate agent, one could not acquire a halfway decent apartment between 400 and 450 square metres. What became evident only later was that it was unlikely, even with the assistance of these agent vermin. It was quite shocking how little these envoys of the rental inferno knew about their own properties. Even after 60 years' absence from the market, I was on every occasion able to locate the fuse box in less than half the time that it took the expert they sent. After the third firm, I started insisting on more experienced colleagues, for otherwise I only got 16-year-olds in suits too large for them. These ignorant youths looked as if they had been dragged straight from their school desks into the front line of property broking. At the fourth attempt, I was actually offered something suitable in the north of Schöneberg. A decent walk from there would take me to the government district, another factor in this property's favour. After all, one never knew how soon my proximity to that area would become essential.
"Do I know you?"
the older agent asked as he showed me the servants' quarters beside the kitchen.
"Hitler Adolf," I said tersely,
adeptly inspecting a few empty cupboards.
"Of course," he said. "That's it. Without your uniform on. Oh, excuse me. And anyway, I thought you'd take the moustache off."
"Whatever for?"
"Well, you know, when I get home, the first thing I do is take off my shoes."
"And I take off my moustache?"
"That's what I thought."
"I see. Is there a room here for physical exercise?"
"A fitness room. The last tenants didn't have one, but before them there was someone from the jury of a talent show. He used the room over there."
"Is there anything I should know?"
"Like what?"
"Bolshevist neighbours?"
"There may have been in the 30s, but then you... how should I put it?"
"I know what you're trying to say," I said. "Anything else?"
"Well, let's see."
I thought melancholically of Gelly. "I don't want another suicide apartment," I said firmly.
"Since we've been managing this property, no one's killed themselves. Not before that either,"
the agent said hastily.
"At least I believe that's the case."
"It's a fine apartment," I said dryly. "The price is unacceptable, however. Lower it by 300 euros, and we have a deal." I turned to go. It was 7:30. After my successful premiere, Madame Bellini had surprised me with some opera tickets. The Master Singers of Nuremberg was being performed, and she had immediately thought of me. She had even said she would come with me. For my sake, she emphasized, as normally she didn't care for Wagner. The agent promised to get back to me about the rent.
"There's not really any provision for discounts," he said warily.
"It is always possible to reverse such a policy if you can count Hitler amongst your customers," I reassured him before leaving. It was unusually mild for late November. The sky had long since darkened. The city hummed and rushed all about me. For a brief moment I was seized by the frenzy of old, the fear of the Asiatic hordes, the urgent desire to increase our level of armament. Then this turmoil gave way to the pleasant feeling that catastrophe had not engulfed us over the past 60 years, that Providence had certainly chosen the right moment to summon me to action, without leaving me too little time to enjoy a spot of Wagner now and again. I buttoned up my coat and wandered through the streets. Some shops were taking delivery of large quantities of fir and spruce branches. When I found the hustle and bustle a little too overwhelming, I ducked into the smaller side streets. I pondered a few changes to certain details in my program, and strolled past an illuminated sports center. Large sections of the population were in tip-top physical condition. Too often, however, these were women. A well-trained body may make childbirth easier. It improves the resilience and health of the mother.